It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour as we look at some domestic politics, but also very much tied to the politics, foreign policy, international relations of the United States. Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick with us in our Ames studio, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Great to have you on as well, Jim.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Yeah. You have to split at half past, so I believe you, Jim, right?
Well, I'll stay on if you like. I mean,
well, no, we're fine. We're all prepared for that. I just wanted to tell our listeners that we have you for the first half hour. Listen to these headlines as we talk about the latest revelations. New York Times, unbelievable turmoil. Trump's first month leaves Washington reeling. Here's from the Washington Post. Donald Trump's White House is on the verge of a raging fire over Russia allegations. Politico, Trump attacks claims of ties between his team and Russia as nonsense. Well, over the course of the past 60 hours or so, the White House has accepted the resignation of the National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. Has issued statements about what contact he and the Trump administration had with Russia during the campaign and transition, and it has had those statements contradicted. Here is White House spokesman Sean Spicer in being questioned by ABC's Jonathan Carl in a press briefing.
Back in January, the president said that nobody in his campaign had been in touch with the Russians. Now, today, can you still say definitively that nobody on the Trump campaign, not even General Flynn, had any contact with the Russians before the election?
My understanding is that what General Flynn has now expressed is that during the transition period, well, we were very clear that during the transition period, he did speak with the ambassador.
I'm talking about during the campaign.
I don't have there's nothing that would conclude me that anything different has changed with respect to that time period.
Okay, it turns out Donald Trump knew for weeks that Flynn had misled the White House about his contacts with Russia, did not immediately force him out. Late yesterday, that other revelation, New York Times reporting that members of Trump's campaign and other associates had contact with senior Russian intelligence officials in the year before the November 8th presidential election. However, U.S. officials told the New York Times they had not uncovered any evidence that Trump's associates colluded to disrupt the elections. So let's get each of your thoughts here to start off with. Jim McCormick, your thoughts on the last 60 hours or so.
Wow, this has really been, a sort of turmoil on the part of the Trump administration. And it's really a problem, it seems to me, because, of course, foreign policy is kind of the area where the Trump administration is least equipped to really go forward. And so to have all of this turmoil in terms of not having a national security advisor, having an active national security advisor, I think is really problematic when you think of all of the recent challenges that we've had in terms of just in the last month, in terms of the actions of Iran with a missile test, North Korea with a ballistic missile test, and, of course, some news yesterday about Russia in terms of, at least from the American point of view, violating the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. So I think it's really, really problematic, and I guess the bottom line is that really Congress has got to investigate this, and there's got to be kind of laying bare exactly what was going on in terms of both the campaign and then in terms of the kind of the contact that the U.S. government and officials from the U.S. had with Russian officials.
Wayne Moyer, your thoughts.
Well, just to build a little bit on what Jim said, to me the most serious problem right now is the National Security Council process is not working. We do not have a very good way of analyzing what's going on in the world and formulating our response. And the White House is in turmoil, so it's not functioning very well. The second problem, I think, is there's now an enormous credibility gap between what the president is saying and the facts that are coming in. And neither of those things augurs very well.
Right. Let me just share some of that you mentioned, Wayne. In specifics, the president on the offensive here, true to his style, the whole campaign and into the presidency, blaming the media and the intelligence community for what he continues to call fake news. A couple of his tweets this morning, a tweet from the president, the fake news media is going crazy with their conspiracy theories and blind hatred. MSNBC and CNN are unwatchable. Fox and Friends is great, he tweets. Another tweet this morning, the Russian connection, nonsense is merely an attempt to cover up the many mistakes made in Hillary Clinton's losing campaign. Information is being illegally given to the failing New York Times and Washington Post by the intelligence community, NSA and FBI, question mark, just like Russia. End of Donald Trump's, one of his tweets this morning. Jim McCormick, what about that? A credibility gap. It is if the president and is living in a different reality than those that we are led to believe from reporting of New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and the like.
Absolutely. I mean, what is going on is he's losing credibility also, even with his Republican base within the Congress. I mean, Democrats have obviously want to take advantage of this, but he's also losing with Republican senators. I mean, senators coming out and say there's really got to be this kind of investigation here. So he can't even rely on that. So I think the credibility gap is really going to filter into the whole policymaking process. It's starting to show up in terms of some public opinion polls. I noticed that this morning there was a poll released with regard to Iowa and the president's approval rating within the state here is at, like, I think it was 42%. Nationwide, it's kind of 48, 49%. So I think that also, that erosion has occurred not only within the Congress, but within the public at large.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the congressional reaction here. Let's focus on the Republican reaction, since the Republicans do control both houses of Congress. Let's listen to a spectrum of reactions and then have you talk about the position that congressional Republicans find themselves in as the majority party, also in charge of the White House. Things not going so smoothly. Congressional Republicans expressing a variety of opinions about whether an investigation is needed into communicating with Russian intelligence or the leaking of that information. To start off, here's Kentucky Senator Rand Paul.
I just don't think it's useful to be doing investigation after investigation, particularly of your own party. We'll never even get started with doing the things we need to do, like repealing Obamacare, if we're spending our whole time having Republicans investigate Republicans. I think it makes no sense.
Okay. Mike Johnson. Here's the Louisiana Congressman, Mike Johnson, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee, speaking with NPR this morning.
Look, there are some serious legal implications here, but it has nothing to do with partisan politics. I mean, the leak of highly classified information by what is apparent here, a number of individuals inside our intelligence community, is the illegal act that I think we need to review. It does merit further inquiry, because we've got to find out if we have a problem internally. That could be a serious threat to the country going forward, and these are very serious implications.
At the other end of the GOP spectrum of reaction, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham from the Senate Judiciary Committee, speaking this morning on ABC.
I want to do a preliminary investigation where members of Congress, myself and Senator Whitehouse, are overseeing the FBI's role in this. I want to make sure myself that these intercepts exist, that the communications are outside the norm. If that's the case, it's time for the Congress, in my view, the Senate, to do a joint select committee where we can look at it holistically, not in a compartmentalized way, to get to the bottom of it. Because if it is true, it is very, very disturbing to me, and Russia needs to pay a price when it comes to interfering in our democracy and other democracies. And any Trump person who was working with the Russians in a unacceptable way also needs to pay a price. And maybe none of it's true, but I can tell you this, the Congress is not fake. There are real members of Congress up here, Republicans and Democrats, who love our country and going to make sure that checks and balances that have been in place for 200 years work, even when the president's in your own party.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham this morning on ABC. So there we have it, gentlemen, all the way from Rand Paul saying it makes no sense to do any investigation, to Mike Johnson, the leaks is what we should be investigating, to Lindsey Graham, very alarmed at what's been happening. Wayne Moyer.
Well, this reminds me a little bit of the Watergate period in the Nixon administration, where Congress wasn't very anxious to pick up the investigation of what was going on. But the charges are out there, and I think they eventually will have to pick up on it. And then I hope the Trump administration doesn't make the mistake that the Nixon administration did, which is try to conceal the facts as they're out there. I think that's what did Nixon in.
Mm. Are you on the same page with Wayne, Jim, when we start recalling the early 70s and Watergate?
Well, I do remember it. I remember watching the Watergate hearings for sure. And there was this kind of drip, drip, drip of things coming out and things being discovered. I suppose the most dramatic during the Watergate was after they had investigated for a time, suddenly there was a revelation of these kind of tapes that were in the White House. And so that sort of goes to Wayne's point that, you know, they were not really forthcoming from the very beginning. And the Trump administration really has got to be careful that is not the kind of pattern that's followed in this situation. I think there's still resistance, though, even though Lindsey Graham is talking about a select committee. I mean, the first burden, it seems to me, is on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate and maybe in the House, but certainly the Intelligence Committee in the Senate to see what they find out first and how vigorous Senator Burr is, who's head of that particular committee, in following through on the investigation.
Join our conversation with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, about the latest revelations in the White House. We want to talk about, of course, other things in this hour as well, looking to Asia, the challenges there in the second half hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. So when we look at the most, and there's so many questions that need answering here, the chief one, or one of the chief ones, has to be now that those conversations have been corroborated, that there were many conversations between members of the Trump campaign before, in the year before the November 8th election. We don't know the content of those conversations, and that's why we can't say there was a collusion to disrupt the election, Jim?
Yeah, we do not know the content of those, and I don't know. I mean, I suppose there might be leaks of some of those conversations that will come out over the next several days or weeks or whatever. But I think I think the Intelligence Committee, because they can do this investigation sort of under an injunction of secrecy here, they might be able to get access to those kind of conversations and to make some judgments. And so that's why it might well be, as I said earlier, the Senate Intelligence Committee that would do most of the heavy lifting here, at least initially, because, you know, in that sense, there would not be the violation of sources and methods that the United States uses in terms of intelligence gathering.
Mm-hmm. Just a few days ago, Michael Flynn resigning, being forced to resign, depending on how you want to characterize it. Wayne, though, the question in your mind must be one that leapt to my mind. Who told Michael Flynn to call Russia?
Well, my sense is there's a whole group in the White House of which Flynn was probably the most central person, maybe Steve Bannon as well, that wants some kind of major reset with Russia, some kind of grand bargain where essentially we take the sanctions off, perhaps recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea, and that then the Russians would work with us in dealing with ISIS. There's been a lot of talk about that. It's hard to get the full grips on what has happened, but conceivably these phone calls were to build in advance of a possible Trump administration the possibilities of this reset.
Mm-hmm.
But what strikes me, Ben, if I could jump in,
sure,
Is that Flynn didn't realize sort of the dangers that were involved in these kind of discussions. And given that he had come from the Defense Intelligence Agency, how could he not know that his conversations were going to be tapped into? And so, you know, it really raises questions about, I guess, fundamentally about judgment here. In terms of this particular individual and maybe others, as Wayne was saying, within the White House, of what they could do before they were actually in control of policy.
Mm-hmm. Flynn is out. Did we know before this, was he a good fit otherwise for National Security Advisor to begin with, Wayne?
I think not. He was fired from his job as head of the National of Defense Intelligence because of a poor administration, and so there were, I think, real questions in terms of his administrative ability to handle the position.
Mm-hmm. talking about,
and that clearly has spilled over into his 24 days as national security advisor.
Right. You talk about this happening and hearkening back to some things reminiscent of the Watergate period. Drip, drip, drip. We have to remember this is 30 days into an administration. Nixon was 60 months into his second term when Watergate started to drip, drip, drip in an uncontrollable way for President Nixon. Kellyanne Conway, we see her face. We hear her words a lot. Counsel to the president. Let's listen to her on this. An interesting exchange on NBC's Today Show yesterday morning, talking with Matt Lauer about the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Here's a bit of that interview.
I think misleading the vice president really was the key here. And I spoke with the president this morning. He asked me to speak on his behalf and to reiterate that Mike Flynn had resigned. He decided that the situation had become unsustainable for him.
But wait
here.
A second.
And of course, the president accepted that resignation.
You're saying that was the straw that broke the camel's back, but the White House knew about that last month when the Justice Department warned the White House that Mr. Flynn or General Flynn had not been completely honest in characterizing that conversation with the Russian ambassador. And they even went further to say that as a result of that dishonesty, he was at risk for blackmailing by the Russians.
Well, that's one characterization. But the fact is that General Flynn continued in that position and was in the presidential daily briefings, was part of the leader calls as recently as yesterday, was there for the prime minister's visit from Canada yesterday. And as time wore on, obviously the situation had become unsustainable.
Kellyanne,
General Flynn.
That makes no sense.
Okay, Matt Lauer there, NBC's Matt Lauer. That makes no sense. So turns out Donald Trump knew for weeks that Flynn had misled the White House, misled the vice president, but did not immediately force him out. When you hear that, Kellyanne Conway is an interesting figure here. Jim McCormick, is she in the loop? Is she not in the loop? She says she's out there asked by the president to address the press.
Well, she seems to be, popping up on television rather constantly. So I assume that, she's going out there and speaking with some authority, or at least has checked some of the information that she's providing. I think part of the explanation, which she didn't go into, might be, well, they were sort of investigating the veracity of Flynn's comments, although, as you say, as Matt Lauer says, this was known for several weeks and why it took so long. And maybe that, again, despite Trump having his reputation as being you're fired, he was unable to sort of engage in that with some of his loyal supporters.
If I could just add one quick thing here. It seems to me that Kelly Conway, the day before Flynn was fired, had publicly defended Flynn.
Yeah.
Yes, she said that Flynn, the president had, Flynn had the full confidence of the president.
Yeah.
Hours before, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so we have a lot of conflicting stories here. We have Wayne Moyer, Jim McCormick with us, our analysts on this Politics Wednesday. John is with us in Des Moines. Thanks for calling in, John. We're coming up on a break, but please chip in your comment or question.
Okay, well, I think there's a more insidious comparison of what's going on here, and it's never talked about as if it never happened, and that was the Iran-Contra situation. Or Ollie North, another military person who was doing behind-the-scenes work for the Reagan administration, getting spare parts and possibly weapons to the Iranians when we had an embargo going on in order to get funding to continue a war that Congress said was illegitimate and immoral down there in with the Sandinistas in Central America. And when that was investigated, it was interrupted by the president, said, look, I'm pardoning everybody, so it doesn't matter who did what. And I think that the pattern has been set, and we need to be very careful about sweeping this stuff under the rug. Mm. Anyway, I'll take your comments off the radio, but I think that's the better comparison, not Watergate. That was a political bouffant. This is about countries who we have deep reservations about, you know?
So, okay, let's get a reaction before the break. John, thanks for joining us from Des Moines. What do you think about that, Jim, the better comparison with Iran-Contra?
I'm not sure because, the Iran-Contra actually involved arms transfers here. I guess ultimately at the very end of the process, yes, there were some pardons given, but there were also trials held for some of the participants. So I think it seems to me in terms of the kind of policy question I would lean tilt a little bit more towards the Watergate experience.
If I could just add very, very quickly, I think there's something in all three situations. And what did the president know, and when did he know it?
Yeah.
And that's, a fundamental issue in all three of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I saw that in the headline this week as well, those two questions. We have a minute or two left here. Jim, before you go, tell us, what are the possible scenarios you can imagine going forward? How will this thing develop? Is it a genie out of the bottle for the president, or can we regain stability here? Can his administration regain stability?
Yeah. The president has promised, to have a national security advisor in place by the end of the week. I don't know if that, there's a couple candidates. On the one hand, I think that if he were able to get General Petraeus to come on board, although Petraeus has his own problems because he's still on probation and still, of course, was convicted of mishandling classified information here. But he clearly has the kind of background and the experience and also the organizational kind of skills to put the National Security Council in shape. One of the things, if he were to invite it, I would ask him to bargain for getting Bannon off the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the president would be engaged in a bargaining process, but that might. I think that would be a very important way for him to get control of the NSC process.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, quickly, before we have about 45 seconds.
I only wanted to say that after Iran-Contra, Reagan did in fact reorganize the White House and did establish control of the national security process. So it has been done in a somewhat similar incident to this in the past.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to break, very quickly, do you see any other advisors or cabinet members teetering in the Trump administration at this point? Kellyanne Conway may be a candidate. John Spicer. Do you agree?
I think Conway conceivably could be, but I think it's going to be hard for Trump to sack a whole bunch of people at this stage of the game, particularly people who are speaking for him. I think Conway may be the most vulnerable.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much. Jim McCormick, thank you for being with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Thanks, Jim, for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much.
Wayne Moyer will be with us in the second half hour as well. He'll be joined by Mary McCarthy. She'll join us, associate professor of politics and international relations at Drake. We'll also pivot our focus to the Pacific region to look at the national security, foreign policy challenges this new administration faces. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Wednesday. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. In just a few minutes, Mary McCarthy of Drake University will be joining us. I wanted to finish up a couple things with you, Wayne. A couple Russian actions and comment by our Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. A Russian spy ship spotted patrolling off the east coast of the U.S. yesterday, the first such instance during the Trump administration. We were talking in the first half hours. Foreign policy challenges do not stop when you have turmoil in your cabinet. Also yesterday, learning that the Kremlin had secretly deployed controversial cruise missiles inside Russia. Quickly, how significant do you see these?
I see the Russian cruise missiles as very significant because that violates the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that was signed back in the 80s. Where both Russia and the United States were to withdraw their intermediate-range missiles from Europe. And the fact that Russia now is putting them back in my mind, completely undercuts the treaty and requires some kind of U.S. response. Close to the United States, and then also there was an incident in the Black Sea. I don't think that has quite the same strategic significance, but it's clearly Putin pushing the United States to see how far he can go before he gets some kind of response. I think all of these things are undercut those who want to reset the relationships with Russia.
Mm-hmm. Also today, I'm reading reports, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis issuing an ultimatum to the allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, warning during a closed-doors meeting with defense ministers from other NATO countries that if they do not boost their defense spending to goals set by the alliance, the U.S. may alter its relationship with them. So I don't know if you're keeping up on these reports from earlier today, what's happening in Europe. Mattis saying America will meet its responsibilities, but if your nations do not want to see America moderate its commitment to the alliance, each of your capitals needs to show support for our common defense. Is that a change? How significant is that?
Well, we've been saying that for years, that the Europeans have to do more. And up until now, and different administrations, every American administration is saying that, up until now, the United States hasn't really put any kind of teeth behind that. I think the message is getting across now, at least in part because of some of the things that Russia is doing now, that we are seeing increases in the budgets of the NATO members. They're not, I think four or five of them are up to 2%. Everybody else is under that. But I think the message is out, and I think that we will see increases.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us. We're now joined also by Mary McCarthy of Drake University in Des Moines, where she's Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you on. We want to pivot a little bit to Asia. Plenty going on there. So hard to cover everything. Of course, the Israeli meeting at the White House today. You can stay tuned for Here and Now at 1 o'clock to get more details on that as it's happening as we speak. But let's talk first of all, Mary, about this North Korean missile test, the reaction to it by our administration. North Korea test fired a medium or intermediate range ballistic missile, flew about 300 miles from the west coast of North Korea over the peninsula, landed in the Sea of Japan. This marks the first missile test by Kim Jong-un since October, the first during the Donald Trump presidency. Now, we had the Prime Minister of Japan here appearing in a press conference. Let's listen to a little bit of that after this missile test by the North Koreans. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and President Trump holding a joint news conference at the president's Mar-a-Lago estate and golf club.
During the summit meeting that I had with President Trump, he assured me that the United States will always with Japan 100%. And to demonstrate his determination as well as commitment, he is now here with me at this joint press conference.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. I just want everybody to understand and fully know that the United States of America stands behind Japan, its great ally, 100%. Thank you.
Okay. The President and the Prime Minister of Japan there in a part of a joint news conference. Mary McCarthy, with your focus on Asia, what are your thoughts on this missile test and the reaction by our administration?
Well, a North Korean missile test was always expected to be one of the first major foreign policy tests for the Trump administration, so this is no surprise at all. It's been argued that the missile test was directed at Japan, and it certainly was, but it was also directed at the U.S. as a test of the new administration to see how they would react, and at its own domestic audience. It seeks to get media attention. It seeks to remind all of us that North Korea is still there. So the test in and of itself is nothing surprising, but the missile itself has been called a game changer. It's more stable, more efficient, harder to detect. It's still probably not the big technical advancement that the U.S. military and foreign policy establishment is watching for, which would be an intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially deliver a nuclear warhead to the continental U.S. So it's not that advancement. But it's still, we can see technical progress that North Korea has been able to make. So I think that's very important when we think about what message they're trying to send, as well as what technological progress we can see in this missile test.
Well, forecast a little bit for us, because it seems only a matter of time before the missiles become more long range. Mm-hmm. And I believe this missile was not a liquid fuel, but a more stable solid fuel, which makes a difference here for an intercontinental or a longer range missile. Now, we've had, Mary, all kinds of sanctions against UN resolution, repeated sanctions, failing to curb the Kim regime. More than, I think, 20 times last year, these test firing of these missiles. Where do you see this headed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Trump said that the U.S. would defend its longtime ally, Japan. So it did. The administration did take a stance against this missile test, certainly. But it was restrained. And the fact that it was restrained has possibly opened the door, or at least the Chinese establishment think it's opened the door, to negotiations with North Korea. So we'll have to see how things unfold. I mean, the administration has said there'll be a broader response soon. But if that broader response does open the door to direct negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea, that would be a real change and something that China is hoping to see.
Weigh in on this, Wayne Moyer, when we talk about the hermit state, North Korea's missile launch here.
I'm wondering if we're seeing a repeat of a pattern. And in the past, North Korea does something like the missile test to begin negotiations. We then negotiate with the North Koreans. They agree to limit their program in some ways, gives us a momentary sense of relief. Then at some stage, the North Koreans violate the agreement, then the situation escalates again. In the meantime, they've gotten some aid from the United States as part of the agreement, and I'm just wondering if this is just a repeat of the same old pattern.
And another facet of this story, your thoughts on this, we know the Trump administration in its first 30 days or so is being accused of jeopardizing national security, some high-profile controversies. The criticism peaking on the weekend when in this missile launch, Donald Trump took a phone call about the North Korean missile test, while sitting in full view of the guests at his private Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. We had pictures, Trump staffers poring over government documents with purportedly government documents, cell phone flashlights, a potential security risk being raised there. how serious, Wayne, do you see these criticisms of what happened there at his southern White House?
Well, the test could not have come at a more inopportune moment, as Trump was having dinner with the Japanese prime minister. But my sense is, had the process been fully in order, the president somehow or other would have adjourned to a room nearby with his close advisors. But to conduct negotiations in terms of what we're going to do among staff in public view, I think is very, very unusual.
We also had a Mar-a-Lago visitor. Remember, this is open to the club members, posting a photo that was later deleted to Facebook that featured and gave the first name for a U.S. military official responsible for holding the black bag containing our country's nuclear launch codes. Mary, your thoughts?
As a political scientist and as an American citizen, I thought it was just fascinating. I mean, you know, this is something we have never seen before. I am wondering how we have seen how the U.S. presidential election, the U.S. presidency has changed with the use of Twitter, this Twitter presidency, and now we are seeing the entire nature of what we think of in terms of national security potentially changing with this Twitter presidency. I mean, I just thought it was fascinating. I do think that we will not see a repeat of this. Mm-hmm. I think that this has gotten so much negative press that we are unlikely to see a repeat of it. But it was a fascinating event.
Mary, your thoughts on the Japanese-American relations in light of this visit by the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Friday, traveling then with the President to Florida to play a few rounds of golf on Saturday. What are each of the leaders looking for in this relationship?
Prime Minister Abe is looking for a U.S. commitment to a continuation of a stable U.S.-Japan alliance where the U.S. remains engaged in Asia economically, politically, diplomatically. So the first thing on Prime Minister Abe's list is the trade agreement. So since the TPP is now dead, he's actually willing to negotiate a bilateral trade agreement, and he is willing to give quite a bit to Trump in terms of press, maybe not in terms of concrete numbers or concrete changes, but in terms of press on, you know, Abe said he was bringing 700,000 jobs for Americans from Japan with this new trade agreement. So trade is very important on Abe's list, but also the security relationship. Japan has very clear interests with regard to North Korea and with regard to China, and Abe wants to impart to Trump the importance of Japan's interests and bring the Trump administration on board with the policy that Japan would like to see, the U.S. policy that Japan would like to see towards both North Korea and China.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the rise of China, a big concern to both Japan and the U.S., Mary. And so the stability of the region, Wayne, a central focus here. We had during his campaign, then-candidate Trump talking about how the Japanese should look after, to a larger degree, their own security. Saying perhaps getting their own nukes?
Right, and there was talk that we would reduce our military presence in Korea and Japan. I think there's been a significant movement on Trump's part since the campaign, and with efforts by him and General Mattis to reassure both the Koreans, and with the visit of the Japanese Prime Minister to reassure the Japanese as well that the American commitment is steadfast.
Let's talk about another development in Asia before we have to end this hour. The apparent, assassination of a North Korean leader's Kim Jong-un's estranged half-brother, Kim Jong-nam. This is the eldest son of the late North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. The second, it's hard to keep these all straight. Perhaps, Mary, you can help us out. The assassination here, an estranged half-brother assassinated? Mary?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a big mystery. Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother, he had questioned North Korea's political and economic system. He'd been influenced by his living abroad. However, he did not seem to in any way be a threat to the Kim Jong-un rule, and it does not seem to be in the interest of Kim Jong-un to assassinate his half-brother. But there may be some palace intrigue of which we are currently unaware, so we'll have to see how this unfolds.
Right. Fox News reporting today a woman carrying a Vietnamese travel document arrested in Malaysia in connection with his apparent poisoning death. So, Wayne, what are your thoughts about this assassination? As we just hear early on about it.
Well, first of all, I think we need to see what the results of the autopsy was. There was some talk that he might have even had a heart attack, and that it wasn't an assassination. I don't know what is true, but I kind of would agree with Mary. There's no incentive for Kim Jong-un to kill him, and it could conceivably be a part of a palace struggle of some sort or another.
Before we end the hour, let me ask Mary for other things that we should watch in the early days of the Trump administration in Asia. Where should we be looking?
The one place we did not talk about is China, of course. And Trump has made an about-face with regard to China, now affirming the One China policy. This was the right policy decision by the Trump administration, but it also puts the ball into Xi Jinping's hands in terms of feeling that the Trump administration was willing to bow to China's interests. So we have to see what happens next in that relationship.
Wayne, when you look back, we step back and zoom back a little bit about the first approximately month of the Trump administration and through a foreign policy lens. What do you see? We had Mexico week one. Trump had a Twitter spat with the Mexican president over the refusal to pay for that border wall, caused the Mexican leader to cancel his trip to Washington. We had the discussions with the British prime minister about NATO. We had reported complaints to the Australian prime minister on a phone call. The travel ban, of course, affecting the whole world.
Well, what strikes me most about it is Trump in various ways was trying to follow through on his campaign promises. But I think the problem is that I don't think he had thought through the consequences of doing each of these things, of being tough with the Australian prime minister, of the travel ban, et cetera. And there are all sorts of consequences to these things that I think should have been anticipated, but were not.
Mm-hmm. Mary, your read on the travel ban as far as Asia is concerned?
It has not directly affected Asia in any significant ways, and we have seen a lot of cooperation with regard to Asian governments as well as Asian airlines. So they have fully cooperated with the U.S. Administration on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about that phone call with the Australian prime minister? Certainly not something either government would like to have had out there. Any lasting repercussions when Donald Trump says after talking with Malcolm Turnbull, their conversation was the worst phone call by far of the day?
I think we often see in diplomacy that there will be these negative events that occur, but we always come back knowing that we have more common interests than disagreements, and we'll see that continue to be the case between the U.S. and Australia.
Mm-hmm. Diplomacy perhaps redefined, Mary McCarthy, with the tweets you mentioned before. Do you think the rest of the world's leaders are on board with sort of conducting diplomacy, at least in part, publicly via Twitter?
They certainly are not, and they are quite uncomfortable with this new Twitter presidency, but I think we also will see this become more constrained in the U.S. case as well, in Trump's case, as the months go on.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, your thoughts on Twitter diplomacy and the like?
Well, I think Twitter diplomacy has problems at home as well as it does internationally. There have been stories in the last few days. Trump Twitters something, and then the National Security Council staff, which has been disorganized, how does it respond to it? How does it turn it into actual policy? And the problem is that policies are complex things, and sort of starting with very short general Twitter observations without working out all the details is a recipe for disaster.
Right, and we've seen that the tweets have a coincidental, not coincidental, relationship to what was on cable TV that evidently the president was watching. So It's hard to know. We'll watch this develop, of course. Wayne Moyer, thoughts to leave us with, what you'll be looking at in the coming week here?
Well, I hope that we get quickly into a full investigation of the contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and that the administration cooperates and that the full story comes out. And we'll have a better understanding of where we are.
Mary McCarthy, what thoughts do you want to leave us with?
Many foreign policy positions remain unfilled, so that's what we're going to have to see, which individuals are going to become the managers of this foreign policy, the day-to-day workings of these relationships between the U.S. and foreign nations.
Mm-hmm. And what positions are those more specifically?
All of the advisors to Rex Tillerson, who will these advisors be? Who will be advising on Asia policy, in particular, my interest? These are things we don't yet know, and they will have a tremendous impact on the policies we see coming forward in the next few months.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how many administrations you've been following, Mary, but is this administration behind in terms of naming those positions, people to those positions?
It is behind. It's slightly behind.
Okay.
One thing, the National Security Advisor is really critical.
Okay. Wayne Moyer, thank you very much for your expertise. Mary McCarthy, thank you. Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in Des Moines. Mary, we'll talk to you again on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Wayne Moyer, always great to have you. Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thank you so much, Wayne, for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, music fans mourning the death of music legend Al Jarreau. Tomorrow, during this time, we'll listen back to my conversation with Al Jarreau from 2014 when he visited Iowa. My conversation with him before a live audience from 2014 tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.